Good Thursday there, football fans. Welcome to the podcast. James Sharman here, alongside, as per usual, John Molinaro. It's a very busy Thursday. Lots of news making the rounds in the football world, JMO.
There is, yeah. The fine and suspension of Maurizio Sarri at Napoli, yep. Although rather tame. But not surprising, though.
Unbelievable.
We'll get into that,
it,
I'm
really?
Sure. We'll get
well,
into that,
maybe
I'm sure.
Not, sadly. Well, let's get into it, shall we? Later in today's show, we'll talk some Ligue 1 with Matt Spiro. But to start with, we'll talk some Italian football with a good friend of the show, Paolo Bandini. Hey, Paolo.
Hey, James. How are you?
Good, thanks. Good. It's been a great news week for the Serie A. Perhaps not all the stories are too savoury. As Jim mentioned there, Maurizio Sarri, who was accused of making homophobic slurs to Roberto Mancini on the weekend, has been given a two-match ban. Are you surprised by this?
Yeah.
Seems very lenient. I mean, if that was in the Premier League or in North America, it'd be far more than two games.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree when you said a great news week. Certainly a busy news week, yeah. But not an especially edifying one. And of course, I'm sorry to say that we've had plenty of these in Italy over the last couple of years, with Tavecchio and all the rest. But no, it's a disappointing response. Certainly the initial reaction was that it was going to be a whole lot more severe, the punishment. They were talking about a 4 to 5 month touchline ban. And the judgment effectively came down to this this decision from the Sporting Justice that it didn't constitute actual homophobia because Roberto Mancini is not gay, was the reasoning given. And so because it wasn't a homophobic insult, it was a lesser grade of insult it was treated as. It only goes down to a two-match ban. And in fact, specifically, a two-match ban, as with most Italian football bans, and I assume this would have been different if they had gone in for a multi-month situation rather than a game-by-game suspension. But most Italian football bans tend to relate strictly to the competition in which they were incurred. So Sarri will get a two-match Coppa Italia ban, which, of course, Napoli are out of the Coppa Italia, so this won't even come into effect until next season.
And it's the timing is unfortunate too, Paolo. And I mean, it'd be unfortunate at any time, really, but especially because of, you know, the good story from the Coppa Italia earlier this week of Alessandria becoming the first third tier team, since 1984, Bari, to reach the semifinals. What a great story that is!
Yeah, it is. And you know, you have to frame this slightly differently to how you might the FA Cup. And as much as there has been a historic tendency of the bigger teams not to take the Coppa Italia so seriously. But what's interesting is actually in the last, I would say the last 5 or 6 years, that's maybe even a little bit longer than that now, probably going back to 2008, 2009 maybe, it's turned around really because we've had a constant situation, I guess with the exception of one brief blip with Milan winning the league in the middle, where the title winner has felt almost kind of obvious. You know, Inter were running away with it for a while, and now Juventus have been running away with it again, a little bit different this season. But that sense of the league becoming a bit more impossible for everyone to win has really kicked a lot of the teams that are just in that category of aiming for the Europa League and Champions League, taking the Coppa Italia much more seriously. And so, yeah, in that context, the fact that we have had teams pushing for it much harder, it's a bigger surprise to see Alessandria coming through like that. And hey, you know, they're going to get their crack at Milan now, and it'll be a really fun game to see how that plays out. And certainly the way Milan have been, it's not implausible to me that could turn into an even bigger upset yet.
And that would be, I guess, good for the tournament in many ways if you see Alessandria in the final, as far as, you know, global appeal, you know, as much as they've made great inroads so far this year. Would you be fair to say?
I mean, you know, it's the exact opposite of what Matita thinks everyone needs, which is, of course, we remember Claudio Latito last year saying that if they brought Carpi and Frosinone out to the top division, this was going to be a disaster and it's going to destroy all his TV deal. So I guess somewhere he's probably spinning and kicking his heels and cursing. But I think most people appreciate these stories. I think most people appreciate any team that's able to punch above his weight and you know, do what Alessandria had done, which is get to a position of the tournament they have no right in being, in much the same way as Carpi and Frosinone, based on their budgets and based on what their financial reality is, should have no right in being in the top flight. And hey, you know, both those teams are currently in the relegation zone. They actually, Carpi have just won two in a row, and I think they're both making a pretty good fight of it. Certainly a better fight of it than Verona are so far this season.
Yeah, they both have four wins so far, right? So they're not exactly pushovers, that's for sure. Back to Sarri, and it's a shame, obviously, on many levels, but Napoli have been a really good story so far. And finally, we think perhaps, maybe, possibly a team is going to end this Juventus run, although they are now just 2 points back and they're playing much, much better. But look at Napoli this year under Sarri, replacing Benitez. Gonzalo Higuain's got 20 goals so far this season. It seems like this whole team has finally found its form at the right time. Is it down to Sarri or is it more than that?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, you know, not that it wouldn't be a bummer if someone else said it, but it, when you're a writer, I'm sure you will be able to empathize with this, both of you. Sometimes when you come into contact with and get to observe someone doing something really remarkable in sport, you kind of will for them to be a good guy with it. And I think that's the thing with Sarri. You know, we have to, in the end, separate these things out, and you always need to separate these things out. And just because he's done something that he doesn't reflect very well on him at all and reflects very badly on him off the field doesn't change the fact that, in purely sporting terms, he has done a remarkable job this season, and that is true regardless of what we think of him as a person. I think you do have to give him a huge slice of the credit for what's happened at Napoli. I think Higuain has been very, very blunt about it, saying, you know, he's motivated me. And I think that there's conversations that went on there at the beginning where Sarri really, you know, you'd think a manager coming in a situation that he is in, a guy who's come up from the lower leagues, a guy whose, you know, biggest job so far was at Empoli, a team who aren't really a fixture of the top flight, let alone pushing on for Europe or anything like that. He's come to a club like Napoli, whose aspirations are the Champions League and maybe in a slightly more ambitious way the title. He came in there and he had no fear of these people. He had no sense of I don't belong here. He challenged Higuain to do better. He encouraged him to do what he did do, which is, you know, this was Higuain's on his own initiative as well, which was to lose a little bit of weight, and that's made him even sharper. And tactically, Sarri has been absolutely bang on. I mean, he's been flexible. He's done, he's adjusted the team when he's needed to, and he's managed to get the absolute most out of that partnership in particular of Higuain and Senior. So as a football coach, he's doing a sterling job. You sort of wish he was doing a bit of a better job as a person this week.
What have you made of Juventus, Paolo? Because this was a team that, you know, obviously struggled at the start of the year, dropping points and dropping wins to teams that they should have quite rightly beaten. Now the hottest team in Serie A with 10 wins in a row, 2 points off of Napoli. It's, you know, it's a title race again. Have they done anything differently, or was this, as Allegri made adjustments, or is this just a matter of, you know, it needed time to gel after losing so many key players in the offseason?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly there was something of it needing time to gel. I think you can look at, you know, I feel like we've talked about it before. I've talked about it before with you guys on this show. You know, when you lose more than half of the goals you scored over the last two seasons, which is what they lost between not only Tevez, but Vidal and Pedro Llorente, of course there's going to be some, you know, some work that needs to be done to get those sorts of understandings and the link-up play and all those things clicking again. And I think you can clearly say there's been some of that. You can clearly say that, for instance, Paulo Dybala has taken a little bit of time just to hit the stride that he's in now, which is phenomenal. I think you know, he wasn't even in the team every week at the beginning, and that was Allegri doing the same thing that he did with Alvaro Morata last year, where he tries not to rush somebody in. And, you know, it's one of those situations that you can argue either way. You can either say, oh, the results right now are proof that he got it exactly right, or you can hypothesize and say, well, maybe Dybala would have scored all these goals right from the beginning if he'd been given those games as well. So, you know, that's a tough one to call on. But I do think what Allegri has done is shown that he's continued to be, and I think this is one of the things that impressed me in year one with him, and it's one of the things that continues to impress me in year two, is He doesn't rest on his laurels. He changes things when he thinks they need to be changed. And you've seen it this season with going back to the three-man defence in a lot of games. That's something that he sort of came in and abandoned from Antonio Conte. And it was his famous change in the Champions League to turn things around against Olympiacos, was to go to a four-man defence. And that got the team winning. And this season, when things weren't working, he was prepared to go back to it. And if it works, it works. And I think that his pragmatism is the thing that is most impressive about him as a coach. There's so many coaches out there who are caught up in their ideals and what they think is the right way to play the game and what they think is the correct answer to a riddle, if you will. And with Allegri, I don't ever get any of that. I think he comes across like he can be slightly vain, perhaps, in the way he presents himself and his, you know, his demeanor off the pitch. But in terms of his football, he's absolutely humble. He's always willing to change and do something different if it needs to be done.
You and I, we chatted about this a few weeks ago on Twitter when we were talking about sort of the title race and whether Napoli can really do it, whether they have the depth of talent, or, you know, especially now with Juventus kind of coming on. What's your feeling? I mean, this is, like I said, it's 2 points that separate the teams. They're both in very good form. Higuain is, you know, top of the scoring list. Hamsik is, I think he's playing his best football at Napoli in years. And then, of course, as we said, Juventus is doing quite well. What's your feeling? Can Napoli hold on and do this?
You know, my feeling is that they won't, and I think that's because the thinner squad will eventually catch up to them. But my feeling is that they, you know, that's kind of a speculative answer based on just a best guess that sooner or later someone important is going to get hurt and something's going to slip. If I'm going on who's played the best football in Serie A this season, I think they have. I think that they really, since a sort of initial month, you know, this is the thing, we talk about Juventus and the ground they've made up. Napoli also had a slow start. Napoli dropped points against a bunch of teams at the beginning of the season because Sarri hadn't got things working yet and he didn't settle on the 4-3-3 formation that has been working best for him for a few weeks. They also have done a lot of making up ground, and basically the form they've been in when they've been at their best, I think that not even Juventus has played to that level yet. But when I look at Juventus' squad and I see how robust they are and how much more well-equipped they are for when someone gets hurt, for when the Champions League fixtures pile up in the new year, you know, if they pile up for Juventus, because I feel there's a little bit of a chance that Juventus might also be in for a sharp exit from that tournament when they face Bayern Munich, which would also, in theory, allow them to focus even more on the league. I think those factors are what add up to make me think that the Juventus are still the favourites. But, you know, like I say, that answer is premised on the idea that Napoli will have some injuries and suspensions are going to catch up to them. If they can be the team that navigates through those things and manages to avoid them, I think they quite possibly have the best first 11, certainly in the way they're playing right now in the league.
Paolo, I've known you for a number of years now, and when I first got to know you, it was around 2009, 2010, I think it was, when I covered the Serie A closely. And we used to often celebrate a little team called Udinese, a little striker called Toto Di Natale, and his manager, Francesco Guidolin, who is now at Swansea, his 16th club, I believe, in about 20 years. We love this guy, though, right? Do you think that's a good signing for Swansea?
Yeah, you know, I think Guidolin's a fantastic manager. I think he, certainly, when you look at what he did at Udinese, I think with any manager, you have to recognize there's a reality here, which is you go to a different club and certainly a different league, different situations. Things won't always work out the same way. But if you're looking for a team that is starting from the same sort of place, a budget that does not put it any way the top section of the league, a setup that is not built to challenge for necessarily the greatest things, is maybe equipped to hold its own in the top division, to sort of swim somewhere down there in the lower half of the table, but shouldn't be aiming much higher than that. That's exactly what Udinese were. And under Guidolin, they weren't that. They were a team that finished fourth in 2011, finished third in 2012, and, actually a kind of heartbreaking team, because to finish, you think, third, they got there right after Italy had lost its fourth Champions League spot. They should have been an automatic Champions League qualifier that year. Because they'd lost the coefficient, they had to go into the playoffs for the second year, and they lost in just absolutely devastating fashion, 2-1 draws with Sporting Braga, and then lost at home on penalties. I think the teams that he built there were so far above their weight, and not just done in this circumstance, like I mentioned, of having a wage budget and a squad that doesn't belong in the top half of the table, but having a squad that is at that level and is also undergoing constant turnover, because the whole business model in Udinese, which people are now more familiar with because the Pozzo family are also involved in Watford, it involves moving players on, bringing players in who are cheaper and moving them on for profit, so you keep funding everything. And he dealt with all of that just absolutely admirably and manfully. And I think he's a really smart football coach who's also a nurturer of talent. And that's why he worked so well in that situation. He was someone who was always prepared to take the new young player on and say, right, how can we make you a better footballer? And that, if he can translate that, you know, with the cultural differences and the challenge of playing in a different league tactically, then yes, I think he's a fantastic choice. I think he's one of, you know, again, you hesitate to say these things, especially in the week we just had, but I feel like he's one of the good guys in football as well.
I agree, yeah. As is, I mentioned that his striker at Udinese, Di Natale, he's 38 now. He was still pretty old when we covered him back in the day, it seems. And as much as that model was about selling players, Di Natale was so loyal, stuck with Udinese. Could have gone to what, Juventus was a big rumour. There's rumours every week, it seemed, about who wanted this guy. He stayed there. But sadly, you don't think he's going to be on his way to Wales?
it would be
amazing, wouldn't it?
And, you know, if ever there was a time, then right now might be the time, because, you know, Di Natale is done at Udinese. He's done. He's not part of the starting 11 anymore, really. He's still playing more as a substitute. And he looks finished to me this season. It's sad to say it, because he's not just a good player. He's been one of my favourite players to watch in the last 10 years. And, you know, it's not always the very best players who are favourites to watch, but someone who plays with that joy in their football makes you want to keep tuning in. And he's a fabulous footballer, and I would love for him to get to have a swan song, as it were, somewhere else.
Ooh, that's bad, pal. Really bad.
Yeah, that was awful. Look, he's on his way out. You know, they're pretty much done with him. They've exhausted what they're going to get from him, I think. And so, in theory, if he was to wake up in the summer, and given that he's threatened to retire before and not done it, I wouldn't completely rule this possibility out. If he was to wake up in the summer and say, "Ooh, you know what, I'm not done after all," then why not? He's got a manager he likes in a situation which would be a new adventure for him. But I think most likely we're just going to see the end of Topo's career at the end of this year.
Wednesday, Paolo, it marked a special anniversary, as it was 31 years ago that Paolo Maldini debuted for AC Milan as a teenager, curiously on the right side of defense. Only made one appearance that year, but then obviously became a starter the following season and went on to become, well, for my money, the best defender of all time. Is there a youngster out there? Obviously, I'm not going to phrase this within the framing of who's the next Paolo Maldini, but is there a young defender there?
That's what he's doing, by the way.
Well, no.
He is.
But is there a young defender out there in Serie A who, not necessarily the next Paolo Maldini, but who can become the next sort of great defender in that mold in terms of being elegant on the ball, being versatile, you know, being able to play a multiple number of positions on the back line, and just being able to sort of quarterback, for lack of a better word, the back line?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question, because the bar that we've just set is so high that anyone whose name I say is going to feel ridiculous. I mean, in terms of the versatility, the maturity and the approach, the ability to do it in different positions and frankly to step in into quite hostile and challenging stages, I think that he's already in the Premier League. Matteo Darmian is the guy I would probably have said to you for the last couple of years. I think I had a very high estimation of him before he went to United. I know it hasn't all been plain sailing there, but I think he's still a very good footballer. If you're looking for the next guy who is going to come along after that, and perhaps a bit younger, because Darmian isn't that young, there's a couple of guys. I think both Alessio Romagnoli, who's, again, you know, it's not been the easiest introduction to life at Milan. It's been a bit up and down, but he's a player who's definitely proven himself in the last year and a half to be a talent worth watching. And I think that Daniele Rugani, who's gone to Juventus after a great season at Empoli, is the other one. He's, you know, we don't get to see him as much at the moment because he's taken himself onto a team where he's playing behind Bonucci, behind Barzagli, behind Chiellini, so his opportunity for playing is not as much as it was. But he is another serious talent, and he wouldn't have been brought, you know, wouldn't have been brought into Juventus if he wasn't. So, you know, with players like that, it can go a bunch of different ways. But what you hope he does is he spends the time there learning from those guys and goes on to become something even more special than he would have been if he was off somewhere else starting every week. I don't know if I'm putting any of these guys in the category you want me to put them
in.
Those are certainly the defenders who I've got an eye on at the moment.
That was some tough question. Jeez. Well, way to treat our guest. Holy smokes. Who's the best young second-string goalkeeper coming up in the third
division? Who's the next Buffon?
Yeah,
right.
Jeez. Paolo, I apologize for that, but a great answer, though, nonetheless. who is the next Paolo Bandini?
Oh, that should
say Maldini. That is a tough one.
That's a tough one,
wow,
too.
Huh.
Yeah.
We'll ponder that one. We'll ponder that one.
Yeah.
There's no one that can come close to Paolo's brilliance, really.
I think I'm you know, I'm going to have to stick with still me. I'm not that old yet.
Well, tell you that there's no one else that I know can cover both soccer, Serie A, and NFL quite as well as, talk about versatile. He is like the Maldini of football.
There you go.
Yeah.
Good point.
Paolo, thanks, mate. Really, always enjoy this. Chat to you soon.
Cheers, anytime, guys.
That's Paolo Bandini. Please follow Paolo, Paolo_Bandini on Twitter. He writes for a wealth of publications, including The Guardian, and for all things Italian football. He is the man. Didn't even get to Spalletti at Roma, returning there.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
You surprised by that? He had success there, two Coppas.
Yeah, not surprised. You know, the writing was on the wall for Rudy Garcia. I think patience had just run out. And that's not to take anything away from him. I think, you know, what he had did there during his brief tenure was really, you know, solid work. And I think he's got a bright managerial future ahead of him. I don't think he'll be out of work for long. But as I said, patience was just kind of growing thin on Roma. They were really faltering. And, you know, Spalletti is someone who I've always admired. And I thought, you know, he obviously did quite very well at Roma in his first tenure, then went to, what was it?
Zenit.
Yeah. Always kind of pegged him as a future potential candidate for the Italian national job. So, which I wouldn't rule out because he's still relatively a young mm-hmm. man. But I think, you know, if he can sort of do well at Roma, maybe not this season, but in the long term and really sort of turn this franchise around, then. Again, I think this is someone who's got a bright future ahead of him as well.
Did he bring Michael Bradley to Roma, or was that someone after him?
That's a good my memory's a little foggy on
that.
I mean, Bradley certainly kind of fell out of favor once he left. There's no question about
precisely.
That.
Like Garcia
was not,
took over, right?
Yeah. So
what I'm doing, I'm trying to conjure some panic in Toronto FC land right now. That's what I'm trying to do.
Oh, Michael Bradley back to Roma? Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
I wouldn't expect that. But no, there's no doubt he did quite well under Spalletti during his time at Rome. Absolutely.
What do you make of this Paro to Chelsea or to Liverpool or to whoever story? He's in Corinthians right now.
Yeah.
I think it's actually loaned to São Paulo.
Yeah.
From Corinthians. Hasn't done much over there.
It seems a desperate
odd,
move,
doesn't it?
Yeah. To you? It does to me.
Absolutely. This guy hasn't done much for a number of years. And we know what he could do. He scored a good rate for Milan when he was healthy, which was very rare. But the Premier League seems a bit of a stretch for him.
Do you remember, you know, the under-20 World Cup that was here in 2007 in Canada? I mean, he was kind of the big star leading into the tournament. Never quite panned out for him.
Him and Gonzo around the same time, right?
The next
force for Brazil.
Right.
And neither one of them really made it to that level. And I think for Paro, it was down to injury more than anything. I mean, he did play very well for Milan.
At times, yeah.
At times,
I wouldn't say he was consistent. He didn't bring that level of consistency that... I think you need to at a club the level of and caliber of AC Milan, but you know there were flashes.
He was married to Berlusconi's daughter,
I believe.
Yeah, and they had a kid, right?
I think that's right. Yeah, I'm not up in all the tabloid stuff, unfortunately.
No?
I don't know. So
liar.
No, I'm not.
You
I honestly
TMZ
don't know.
Every night you go home and you just sit on the couch and watch TMZ.
It's funny you bring that up. Did you see the video today with Del Piero?
No.
So I think he lives in Los Angeles now. And so he was walking down the street in Hollywood or something like that. And TMZ was there. And the guy kind of chats him up. He said, hey, big soccer fan. And then you know how they're always asking oddball questions. So what do you think he asked him about? Not about football.
Let me guess. He asked, who is the next Baldini? Maldini.
Ouch.
Baldini. Maldini.
Ouch. No, he's like, what do you think of the Olive Garden?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the answer?
And so I don't think...
The Olive Garden's huge in the States.
But I don't think Del Piero really knew what it was, right? He was just kind of hemming and hawing, and like his back is towards the camera. He's like, I think it's great, whatever. So it was pretty funny stuff.
Great bread.
I'll take your word for it. I've never eaten at the Olive Garden.
Really, ever? It was around here in Canada for a while.
Are they not here in Canada anymore?
Or? I don't think so. I haven't seen one around for years.
I've got my own Olive Garden in my kitchen. I can make Italian
anytime.
You make
a lovely arugula salad too.
I do.
Yep.
Very good.
You should post some more pictures.
It's been a while. Yeah.
Yes, do that.
Yeah, I should.
It'll make my salivate when I see your meal preparations.
Yeah, I'll do more. Because it's more during the summer when all the fruits and vegetables and are really in.
Have you bought cauliflower recently, by the way?
No.
Ludicrous.
Why?
$8.
What, a head?
$8 a head. 8 $8 a head for cauliflower.
Is it an organic one?
Nope.
Just regular?
Regular, normal, boring
cauliflower.
Cauliflower, which I love. So versatile.
Wow.
It's insane. Now the excuse is,
why is it dollar so expensive?
And climate issues where they grow cauliflower, but it's a crisis. It's a cauliflower crisis.
Wow.
I haven't had it for ages. I love my cauliflower. I make all sorts of wonderful cauliflower dishes.
I gotta be honest, I'm not the biggest fan. I don't think I've ever cooked with it. So if it's served to me, I'll have it, but I don't.
You're in a health kick right now. You should try some cauliflower rice.
Well, not at $8 a head.
Replace your rice as cauliflower. Yeah, not enough. $8 a, you're right.
That's ludicrous. Insane.
Not be about it.
Wow, this went off the rails real
quick. It's like a Monday podcast.
Yeah, I know. What's going on?
Should we move on then from some Italian cooking to some French cooking?
Yeah, let's do that.
Segue. Ligue 1 is looking somewhat predictable, at least at the very, very top of the table these days. PSG, 18 wins, 3 draws. They're 19 points up on Monaco already, J-Mo.
So the title race not as close as Juventus-Napoli, as we were discussing.
Not quite. No. I would put some money on PSG winning this right now.
That might be a good bet.
Yeah, I think they might do it this year. We're joined by French football expert Matt Spiro. Matt, thanks for joining us here. Is there any hope on the horizon, maybe next year or the year after, that perhaps we might get a title race in France?
No, not at the moment. Thanks for having me on, by the way. We had a good title race last year. It was only decided 2 weeks before the end of the season. This year, I mean, there are two things. PSG have been much more ruthless, and the other sort of supposed candidates have been absolutely terrible and have had all sorts of problems. Talking about Lyon and Marseille, who are, I think, down in 8th and 9th at the moment. Monaco, who have been very average, and I commentated their game last weekend against Lorient, and they won 2-0 and went up to second. But I mean, it was anything but convincing, anything but impressive. So everybody else has got an awful lot of ground to make up, and PSG are not going to slow down. Well, they're not showing signs anyway in terms of their spending. They only added one major new signing last summer, Di Maria. Who, after a slowish start, is really making the difference now. He's been excellent. He's just been voted Player of the Month for December. In terms of the competitiveness of the league, there's a lot of talk at the moment about, you know, what is going to happen in the next few years. It is of concern. A lot of people could see it coming and maybe were surprised it took PSG this long to sort of really become this dominant. But it is a problem. It is a problem, and people have to hope A, Lyon get their act together. They've got this fantastic new stadium that they've just moved into, almost 60,000 seats. They've got to get a better team, even though they did very well last year. But you know, they've got the infrastructure, they've got the finances in place, if not to rival PSG, at least to put together a strong side. And Marseille, and the talk around Marseille is that if they're going to become competitive again, they're going to have to be bought by somebody. And the Margarita Louis-Dreyfus, who is the widow of Marseille's former owner, Robert Louis-Dreyfus, is putting everything in place behind the scenes, reportedly, to try to sell the football club and to try to make it as attractive as possible. But at the moment, Marseille are not able to compete. So, yeah, it's a little bleak. From that perspective. On the other hand, if you look from second place down to 19th, it is incredibly tight because you've got PSG way ahead at the top. You've got Troyes, who haven't won a game yet, and they're bottom. But anything can happen in the rest of the league in terms of obviously relegation and European qualification.
PSG also in the news this week, Matt, because Edison Cavani apparently being linked to Man United. What's your take on this? I mean, do you see him actually leaving? And what have you made of his time at PSG, especially in the last year?
Largely disappointing, largely underwhelming. I can still remember the player he was at Napoli when he was very much the main centre forward and could lead the line on his own and cause all sorts of problems to defences on his own. He's had to play second fiddle throughout at PSG to Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He spent most of his time playing on the left wing. If you look at his goals record, considering his play on the left wing, it is hugely impressive. Almost a goal a game, a goal every two games, averaging more than that this season. His work rate is pretty good, but he's never looked as though he's fitted in, really. He's never looked like he's kind of part of the team. There's a decent spirit at PSG, but he seems to be a loner and always has been. And there's been a very... I've found it a very strange story that's come out into the press in recent weeks, and that is that L'Equipe ran this big story that before Christmas, PSG had a meeting that involved Laurent Blanc and a group of four senior players. I think it's Ibrahimovic, Motta, Thiago Silva, and possibly Nicolas Duchesne, who's the reserve goalkeeper, but is seen as an important player in the dressing room. And in this meeting, Edinson Cavani's case was discussed. They were not happy that he'd gone home to Uruguay early for the Christmas holidays. They weren't totally convinced about his story about being injured. And last year, he came back late. And so all this was leaked in the press. Laurent Blanc then came out and said, listen, it's no big deal. But yes, we did discuss Edinson Cavani. It was one of several. So I just find it amazing that everybody is admitting that they're all discussing openly Edinson Cavani, who, you know, as if he's some young kid who, has got a bit of a discipline problem. I can't believe he is especially happy at the football club. And ever since this episode, just before Christmas, he's been very much on the fringes of the team. And it's not at all certain that he'll be a first choice player for the upcoming Champions League matches.
Now, if he is on the way out, and there are obviously rumours about him heading to where else but the Premier League, but and there's meetings about him, does that suggest, though, that Ibra isn't leaving this summer and might re-sign at PSG?
Well, you know, a couple of months ago, I think everybody was sort of happy that, you know, Ibra was going to go out with a few trophies. He was going to score a few goals. But let's face it, looks way past his best and wants to probably finish in the MLS. I honestly can't see Ibra going to the Premier League. I know these rumours, they resurface every few weeks, but you know, I've spoken to him, I've interviewed him a few times, and there's no way he's going to risk his reputation. I don't think he wants to go to the Premier League at this stage of his career. However, at the moment, he is in brilliant form, and his goal scoring, you know, I think he's fully fit now. He's a lot more mobile. He looked so immobile in the early weeks of this season. And suddenly, yeah, people are saying, well, hang on, you know, maybe Ibra should be persuaded to stay for another year or two. I don't think he is necessarily going to disturb the whole equation here. I think either way, they're going to replace Edinson Cavani, I think, this summer. If Zlatan goes, then they need to make high-profile signing. They've talked, obviously, for a long time about Cristiano Ronaldo. They worked very, very hard, and I think we'll continue to work hard to bring Ronaldo to Paris. There's recently been talk of Lewandowski. We've talked about Neymar in the past. These are obviously incredibly difficult targets to get, but PSG will want that big name, high profile signing to continue to promote the club around the world. If Ibra stays, then you know maybe they'd be happy for a smaller sort of 50 million signing like Lukaku.
Well, yeah, small one there. Were you surprised at all, Matt, by the coaching change that Rennes made yesterday? I mean, they're sixth in the table, but they let Philippe Montagnier go. Did that catch you by surprise at all?
It wasn't a big surprise because Montagnier has been under the microscope for quite some time, but it was pretty awful the way Rennes went about it.
Right.
Like you say, they're sixth in the league at the moment. The football's been a bit disappointing ever since Montagnier took over 3 years ago, and they are a perennially frustrating football club because they do have the potential. They have a big backer. They're backed by François Pinault, who's one of the big retail giants in France, but puts no money really into the football club, or very little. But the way they've gone about it, I think, has been dreadful in that they brought in Roland Courbis, who is a guy who's coached in France for 30-odd years. He's on the radio and telly all the time over here. He's quite a, you know, like a high-profile personality. And, you know, and he's a coach. He's a manager. And they said, oh, he's just coming in to help us out because we're trying to make the next step. And he's going to be advisor to the president. He didn't really have a proper defined role. And everybody says, but don't worry, Montagnier's fine. And he's not going to interfere with Montagnier. You know, Rennes have also got Mikel Silvestre, who works... as a sort of sporting director, and you just think, why are they bringing Roland Courbis in? And there was all this guarantees that it's not to threaten Montagnier. And then, yeah, one defeat in the cup, and the next morning, Roland Courbis is taking over as manager. And I just think it's been a very sort of classless way of dealing with Montagne, who's a good guy, even if he hasn't been a major success.
It's obviously a big, big year coming up for French football with Euro in, obviously, this summer. And you look at the French team, and you know, no doubt they are, you know, oozing with talent, some young talent too. Some players have really emerged though too, perhaps at least for us that mainly follow, you know, the Premier League, for example. For example, N'Golo Kanté at Leicester, he's been a standout. I think he makes most people's Premier League team of the year so far. Coming from Cannes last summer, are you surprised by his emergence and what he's become?
A little bit. I mean, I knew he was a very good player. He'd only had one season in the top flight in France, and he was brilliant in the first half of that season. And people thought, well, you know, this could be a future star. He then faded quite a bit. I think the Premier League really suits his style. He's got good technique, and he's able to accelerate very, very well over sort of 10, 15 yards. So, you know, he's got that ability to break through tackles. You know, and the speed of the Premier League, the way that midfielders, you know, throw themselves in at tackles, he's very good at being elusive and giving momentum to attacks. But yeah, I said good signing, but honestly didn't expect him to have that sort of impact, and obviously didn't expect Leicester to do quite what they've done this season. I don't think he is quite going to make it in terms of getting into the squad before the Euros. Personally, I would be very tempted to get him in sort of in March when France are playing their next friendly, and to see how he gets on in the squad and to give him a bit of playing time. Because, like you say, this guy has, you know, he's come from nowhere. Deschamps is very big on continuity. I was talking before to people even last season about Francis Coquelin at Arsenal as well, who never gets a mention, and as far as I'm aware, is not being considered at all by Deschamps. He's obviously injured at the moment. And there is a bit of space in that midfield, I would say, because you've got a lot of players who are either out of form, injured, or not playing as much at the moment. Lassana Diarra, who's another one who's had a terrific comeback with Marseille. He is the most likely starter alongside Matuidi and Pogba in the midfield three. You've got Cabaye, who is still very much, I'd say a fixture in the squad, if not in the team these days. But yeah, behind those four, there are probably still a couple of places up for grabs. So who knows? Maybe Deschamps will surprise us. But generally, he's been reluctant to make too many changes.
One player who we know isn't going to be at Euro is Karim Benzema, which understandable considering the controversy with the scandal and everything, but too bad for France in the sense that he's been lights out this year. I mean, he's been very good for Real Madrid, scoring at a regular rate. I don't know what's been the reaction in France to all this, and is there any chance that they might sort of change their mind and let him in?
Yes, I mean, it's not done and dusted yet by any means. He's been suspended until further notice, you know, or made unavailable for team selection until further notice. But I mean, no, it's a debate that is very much ongoing, and is going to dominate, a lot of the talk shows in the coming months. There is a feeling that perhaps, you know, the groundwork is being done to bring him back. It's obviously a massive decision. He's he's very, very good, and he is France's best player. I mean, you know, maybe Pogba is threatening that accolade, but I mean, you know, in the last few years, Benzema's been the main man since sort of Ribery declined. So, you know, Mathieu Valbuena recently said that he would accept it, he wouldn't have a problem if Karim Benzema played. Every interview that is done these days with a France player or a coach, the question always comes in, what do you think? And should Valbuena and Benzema play together? The other issue is Valbuena, who is a favourite of Deschamps and who tends to produce his best football when he's playing for France. But he's having a very poor season so far with Lyon. He's just come back from his latest injury. So we have to see, you know, he has to be worth his place in the team as well. And if Valbuena gets injured again, or if Valbuena continues to be poor, then that might also make it easier, if you like, to bring Benzema back in. But, you know, it's really the last thing France needed, isn't it? They seem to they seem to be like the champions that are finding original disasters before major tournaments, whether it's sex tapes or underage prostitutes or, you know. But we will see. But there's no doubt Benzema would be a big miss. You know, it's probably Olivier Giroud who'd be the first choice. Different sort of player, doesn't have the mobility of Benzema, but obviously Giroud having a good season with Arsenal as well. Other players in form like Griezmann. So, you know, there are still goals in this team, but Benzema would be a massive loss.
And you wanted to, you know, if Valbuena got dropped and Benzema recalled, optically how that looks Ooh. On the team as well, pretty sorted. Matt, thank you so much for this. We'll keep reading your stuff and we'll chat to you real soon.
Thank you very much. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
That's Matt Spiro. Follow Matt on Twitter, @MattSpiro. He works at BN Sport, writes and broadcasts.
Yeah,
and
based in Paris.
Based in Paris. Tough gig.
Yeah, very tough, eh?
Jeez. Nice. I'd love to live in Paris for a bit. I really would. Now, before we leave, some news to get to.
Breaking news?
No, I would say breaking. It was breaking about an hour and a half ago.
Oh.
2 hours ago. Mascherano. Javier Mascherano.
Oh, right.
Has been essentially told you're going to jail. Tax evasion for a year, unless you can pay this huge fine, about €1 million, which he'll obviously pay. But more tax issues for Spanish-based players. Of course, Messi is going to court. At the moment, it's going to be during Copa America, I believe, this year, yes. If not just before.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get the court dates changed. I wonder if I was done for some, tax evasion crime. And
whether they would accommodate
you? I told
the
government, I've got a TV show that day. I've got to host the Premier League. Can you change the court dates?
Right.
Probably not.
I think you have to score 50 goals a season to get the court date.
You think so, yeah? Okay. Other news. You hear this whole Football Leaks website? It's interesting.
No.
I guess it's a play on WikiLeaks, but they've divulged information that says that Gareth Bale was, in fact, the highest paid player in the world. Sorry, highest, most expensive player, highest price transfer in the world, more than Ronaldo's. But Real Madrid kept it hush-hush so not to offend Ronaldo. You got to read the story. It's fascinating. Now, it's a bit murky because they're using because there's installments on the deal between Spurs and Real Madrid, and now how the Euros changed its valuation compared to Sterling. It's now worth more than it was initially, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
But it just speaks as to the way they've been trying to protect Ronaldo and how he wants to be considered the most expensive player in the world and wouldn't have been happy, apparently, had it been divulged that, in fact, Gareth Bale. Fascinating story.
I mean, if that's true and if his ego is that frail, then my God, come on.
I know. Now, you wonder how much Jorge Mendes is involved in that, too. He wants to have the
highest-priced
player
under
his books, but it really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absurd. I mean,
it's going to get broken at some point.
Right.
Maybe this summer.
It could be.
Pogba. What's Ronaldo worth now, though? What's Ronaldo worth now? He's 31. Say, for example, as you believe, you know, PSG or Manchester United want to buy Cristiano Ronaldo.
Right.
At 31, what is he worth now?
I still think he's worth quite a bit. I mean, maybe not the world transfer record, but pretty damn close to it. Just from a commercial perspective, too. I mean, it'd be a boon for whoever team landed him. And he's still, I mean, at 31, but he's a very young 31. And I still think he has plenty of gas left in the tank.
And what you're getting for the player and what he does in the field right now is worth obviously as much as anyone, but it's just he's 31. And what point does he decline?
Yeah.
Are we seeing that already?
I mean, everyone keeps going on, he's starting to decline. I don't see it. I still think
he's adapting his game.
Yeah. Right? He's still brilliant. He's still pretty fast. He's still pretty good on the ball. He still makes things happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think he's deteriorated that much.
Other news quickly, TFC active once again this past week, Clint Irwin.
Yeah.
Arrives between the sticks. Good signing.
Potentially. Yeah, we'll see. You know, it's kind of asked this of Tim Bezbachenko on the conference call this week when we're talking about Clint Irwin and how is he an upgrade on Joe Bendik and Chris Konopkin. He really wouldn't go there because he didn't want to get into, you know, comparing goalkeepers. But I do wonder how much of a lateral move this is. I mean, he talked about the chemistry not being right at the back line with, you know, the defense and the midfielders and the goalkeeper, which is fine. I don't know. Is Irwin significantly better than Joe Bendik? Mm-hmm. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, All-Star last year.
Yeah, although the game was played in Colorado, so you wonder how much that played into effect. A cheap option because I think he makes less than $100,000. So there's that. I mean, mm-hmm. it's on paper, there's potential there. I'm not prepared to say this is like a home run yet. That's all.
Sure, sure. But given the defensive reinforcements this year, he's going to have an easier time of it, you think?
You would think.
The previous
you would think.
Guys, right?
Yeah. You would think. But again, this is Toronto FC.
I know. Like, we're trying to figure out what is their starting 11 on Monday's pod, right? It's a bit difficult right now because you don't know what formation they're going to be playing.
Well, that's true.
Can you get with the Sherry? Is Sherry starting? Is Will Johnson beside him?
I think, yeah.
Is Azorio playing in his preferred wing role?
I think so. I think
with Bradley.
In a more advanced sort of role. I think they're going to go with the four of Shea Rue, Osorio, Bradley, and Will. Mm-hmm. And then, obviously, Altidor and Jovinko.
4-4-2?
Yeah.
4-4-1-1?
But have either... Not have Jovinko and Altidor as two out-and-out strikers. Maybe one have one more withdrawn. Maybe Jovinko as the more withdrawn kind of that playmaking kind of role. And have... Altidor in a more advanced position as a forward.
Is it almost a diamond as well, midfield? Is that your thinking?
I think so.
Like Shea Rue at the base, Bradley at top, and then...
Or Will at the base and Shea Rue outright. I think they could shift
him
out
right there.
Huh? I think so.
Yeah?
I think so.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Or maybe Shea Rue doesn't make the top, doesn't make the starting lineup, and he's more as a substitute, because I think at this point he's become more of a luxury player, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Especially now with Will.
Well, mostly on his... On what, 3 and change?
Oh, I don't think he's on that much.
Is he not?
No, I don't think so.
Be interesting, though. I mean, and quite frankly, given the number of call-ups this year with Copa, with qualifiers, right. with yada, yada, yada.
And Jovinko might be away for Euro.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need the depth.
Yeah.
That's what, yeah. I mean, listen, it's been a great off-season, I think, for TFC. I heard that before, mind you, but it has been a good off-season.
I have to hand it to them.
How they're going to fit into a system.
I have to hand it to them. They have gone out in a very systematic way and gone out and addressed the major holes on the roster.
Using press releases, too.
Yeah.
As opposed to press conferences.
Yes. So, I mean, I am encouraged by that. But again, how will this all come together on the field, on the actual pitch? And again, is Greg Vanney the man to sort of bring this all together? I mean, I like Greg a lot, but is he the man to sort of, as I said, bring this all together?
Well, what's he learned?
I don't know.
What's he learned on the job, too, right? I mean, he's been there for a year and a half or thereabouts. Right.
Yeah.
So he's obviously learned. He's made mistakes. He probably knows that.
But he's firmly on the clock now. Like,
no,
there's going to be very, very little room for error now.
8 games in the road to start the season, though.
Yeah, I know.
How do you judge a coach?
Well, I mean, Bill Manning, when he was introduced as the club president back in whatever it was, October or November, he set a goal of 8 points from that run. So
that's
the bare minimum.
Time, right?
They did, but that's the bare minimum. And you have to wonder if it's 7 or if it's dead on bang eight, does he stick with Vanney or does he make a change?
Yeah.
Jason Kreis is still out there and he knows Bill Manning from their time together in Real Salt Lake. So it'll be an interesting story to watch.
It might be a newsworthy season at TFC for a change.
Yeah. Jeez. Well, never
dull. Looking forward to the changes though in the stadium, I have to say. Really am.
Yeah, I drove by the other day and could see the canopies over the both the east and west end. So yeah, looks good.
I actually picked up part of a season ticket group this season for the first time.
Oh really?
Get a few games. Yeah.
Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah, I enjoy going down there. It's fun. It's fun. And then you watch. I'll probably be scheduled to work each home game now.
Yes, I'm in the press.
And I'll just waste my money.
Your millions.
Yeah, millions. All right, JMO, that was fun. Our thanks to Paolo Bandini. Our thanks to Matt Spiro for some Italian and French talk. Dobby and Dunlop are back on Monday. I am off for the next week. You may or may not be back here next Thursday.
Yeah, I don't know. Play
we'll
it by ear.
Yeah?
It's not the same without. It's not the same without you. So
much better, probably.
That's true.
More intelligent. Get some guests.
Oh, no question about that.
I actually reduced the IQ in this room when I arrive. All right, we're done. Brent Gunning behind the glass. Thank you. Cheers for